Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 55 of the Footmarks podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter. And with me, back after vacation, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. And the topic for this particular podcast is Cricket in America, which is also the title. And Jared, there is documentation of Dutch settlers from New Amsterdam playing a game of hitting a ball in Manhattan Island all the way back in 1656. However, we do not know for sure if that game was cricket or not. But we do have evidence from the year 1709 from the diary of William Byrd. I think that's how you pronounce it. He was a British planter, author, and slave owner in Virginia. And he basically wrote down some words about playing cricket with his mates. That is more than 300 years ago, which will probably shock some of our listeners and viewers.
Yeah, I actually... It's a separate piece in this, but I did find another one where there's the guy who wrote the, you know, the Durand line as a Pakistani.
Yeah, of course I know the Durand line.
When I was researching that guy, I think he was, so he's not a very famous guy. I didn't realize that. I just thought if you have a line named after you, it must be pretty important.
Dude, they got a guy from the UK who had never lived in the area to draw a line between two countries which are fighting to this day.
Yeah, I know. But what I mean is I would have at least thought he was famous at that stage. And he's not even famous. It's like, it's such a random thing. Anyway, there's a report of him playing cricket really early on in America, in an American newspaper. So you do realize how often cricket was involved in American culture, you know, for a very, very long time, all the way through, you know, George Washington and all these sorts of things. You can go further, of course, you know. No one knows exactly when baseball and cricket split up, right? Although I'm working on a project about it at the moment. But essentially, they were pretty interchangeable and probably came out of the same original founding sport, right? If baseball wasn't split from cricket, which it doesn't look like it was directly, they both came out of the one founding sport, but baseball got big later on and cricket got big earlier and those sorts of things. But you go back and you do realize how much cricket was played in America for a very, very long time.
Yeah, we'll get into all of that fun stuff, but... coming back to the 18th century, cricket actually became quite popular in the USA, with the first recorded match being held in 1751 between New York City and a London 11. That was 7 years after the laws of cricket were written in England. And in 1754, Benjamin Franklin actually brought back a copy of the laws of cricket from England to the States. Now, it must be serious business if one of the founding fathers of the USA cared about cricket.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also tells you how important England was to America. I know these days we don't think about it that much, you know, since the Tea Party and, you know, all the things that have happened ever since. And America has certainly become its own country in a way that a lot of other former colonies never did, right? I don't know if it was it America even, yeah, I suppose it was technically a colony, but certainly, you know, the amount of people that moved over there not from England, separated from England, a lot easier than other countries did. But yeah, you look back and there are so many famous people that are involved in cricket or aware of cricket all the way through. Have you ever, this is completely off topic, but I just looked it up the other day, Dwight Eisenhower. You know, he is the reason why Pakistan stopped playing on matting pitches in test matches, right?
That I did not know. I did know that he, you know, was a part of, or not a part of, but he was viewing one of the test matches in Karachi back in 59 and 60, which is actually quite famous over here in Pakistan. I think Ayub Khan was the dictator back then, and he had very good relations with America. So I did not
exactly
know about the matting pitches.
And so Richie Beno and Sam Loxton were both complaining to Dwight Eisenhower that cricket should be played on grass, not on matting. And Dwight Eisenhower apparently said to the, was he president at that time, prime minister?
Yeah, I think so, president. Yeah. America always has presidents.
No. The Pakistani guy whose name I've just forgotten.
Oh, he was the dictator president dude, right?
Yeah, like president, yeah.
Big guy.
So Eisenhower said to him, I thought cricket was played on grass. And that was the last test match in Pakistan that was ever played on matting. So again, you have, this is, what, 1959, 1960, as you said. It's one of those years. It's around that period. It's still that important at that stage. Like, for instance, Bradman meets Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
Right? And they meet on purpose, knowing the reason for their meeting. You're the most famous guy in this, and I'm the most famous guy in that. People knew of Bradman in the US, right? That actually tells you that there was still, there was an environment of cricket out there. Now, a lot of that has been written out because the American sports got so big. But for a very long time, it kept popping up because America had this link to England and cricket was kind of there.
Yeah, no, very, very true. And America was interesting, right? It was several different colonies for a long time. The Spanish yes. were there, the French were even there. And then, of course, they became independent. But talk to me about the sport called wicket that Americans invented. Apparently, it had 30 fielders, 3 innings, and matches were completed within a day. That is the sport that apparently George Washington even played in 1778, 2 years after the USA became independent.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of great books on the origin of cricket, right? And part of that is that it's kind of so old, no one's quite sure. But because there's a lot more money in America, we know a little bit more about the origin of baseball over the last couple of years. And so wicket is clearly a combination of cricket and baseball, right? Ooh. It has elements of both of those things involved and was probably more a communal sport. Now, the interesting thing is that cricket and baseball probably both come out of one sport and themselves, which is a sport called stoolball, right? And stoolball is naturally a combination of cricket and baseball because that's where those two sports came out of. And I would assume that, and if you look, I've read up a lot about the history of baseball in the last couple of years. I'm trying to do a big project on the origin of cricket. And there's some things I think I found out that I think other people haven't put together before and a few other things. But the basic premise of it is that we there are lots of different versions of cricket and there are lots of different versions of baseball. And then occasionally, like a sport like wicket, which George Washington played and was quite popular, is probably, and this is where it gets really bizarre, the two sports coming back together. So they split and then they magically come back together. But it also, you know, if you go through it, as you were saying before, the laws of cricket were only written in the late 1700s. And even then, there were different laws of cricket in Ireland, for instance, than there was in England. And so I think it was, and the same, I'm pretty sure, I can't remember the country, but I think it's Germany has a version of baseball that is different to the normal baseball, right? And so what happens is as these sports grow, people don't have written stuff to look at and go, this is what the sport is. Like when you're talking about Benjamin Franklin getting laws before, it's probably because he was annoyed that he knew the laws in one way. And in New York, they played it in a different way. And in Philadelphia, they played it in a different way. And so you have all these different things sort of coming out of it. And if you think about the early part of sport, you know, American football, rugby league, rugby union, Gaelic football, Aussie rules football, these sports are all linked in different ways to each other. And then they all kind of just spin off. And we think of them as fully grown sports. But actually, at one stage, they probably all came out of one or two different sports. And they grew on their own. So I think cricket's exactly the same. And you know, that's probably what wicket was for however long they played wicket. And obviously, cricket and baseball probably overtook it.
Yeah, no, definitely. I remember going to, I think it was the Oval, you know, museum. They've got a really small one in there. And they have the oldest design of what a cricket bat looked like. And it looks like a hockey stick. So I'm guessing that's stool ball.
No.
No?
That is cricket.
No way.
So this is a huge, you said before this podcast, no diversions. And now you've just opened that up. That was because in those days, you rolled the ball on the ground. So it made sense to have something like that. Stool ball, the stumps were actually in the air. So it's a lot more like baseball, right? And my understanding of it is that you played it and you put the stool was actually, and this was different. Some places played with the stool on the ground, cricket. Some places played with the stool in a bush, baseball.
Okay.
So you had different kinds of bats and probably the bats were very different, I would assume, in many different ways. I don't have my stool ball kit here. I bought some stool ball stuff. It's fascinating. Gray Nichols made stool ball kit, which is my favorite thing in the world. Anyway, I'm absolutely obsessed. If anyone ever wants to buy me a random present, buy me as much stool ball equipment as possible, especially the Gray Nichols balls, which are like baseballs, but with Gray Nichols on them. Anyway, the point being in the early part of cricket and the early part of sport, it is so big. Cricket, I think, has a better heritage than other sports, largely because the people who played it wrote about it. My guess is that there are probably a lot of sports that were really, really big, but maybe didn't get written about in newspapers, right? And maybe didn't get discussed as much. And baseball was one that sort of, you know, it's America's pastime. It sort of filters through farm fields and everything, it probably didn't have as much writing early on. There's a lot of myths about the birth of baseball, for instance, that it was invented by an American. And it's like, well, it pretty clearly was played in Europe before that. You know, all these different things that we find out. And it's because a lot of those sports weren't written about. Whereas cricket, as you said, we can go back to the 1600s and find probably mentions of cricket right across different parts of the world.
Yeah, it is incredible. And when I'm there next month, you have to show me the stool ball kit. Don't forget. I need to see this. Yeah. Anyway, post-independence, Americans lost interest in most things British, which you can imagine. But cricket remained surprisingly popular. And by 1800, about 5,000 people were playing cricket in Philadelphia and New York. And in another 50 years after that, we saw it spread to 22 states and about 1,000 clubs. Newspapers, as you mentioned earlier, were actually covering cricket far more than baseball back in that day. And I find that extremely astonishing.
Yeah. And I think that, again, goes back to the sorts of people, right? It's, you know, up until recently in the UK, cricket probably had prevalence more so than it deserved in the media at times because of the people who did it. Here's a fun fact for you. Every couple of years, they do an audit of all the websites that UK government people use. And every single time, Crickinfo is really high up. Because the sort of people who work for governments are educated people from the middle class or above, and they usually have an affection for cricket. So, of course, they use Crickinfo, right? And so it's higher up on their list. But it's always mentioned in the articles of, you know, because they're talking about class, right, and caste at that point. That's what the Daily Mail was trying to have a go at those people. Look at all these posh guys looking at cricket, right? I think it would have been the same in America at that period. The sorts of people who are writing, the sort of people they were writing for, the sort of people they were writing about would have more been involved in the cricket side of things than they would have been. I mean, basketball hadn't even been invented. You know, American football was probably still evolving. Ice hockey was probably just in Canada at that point. So baseball is probably the American sport at that stage. But it is played by people out in farms and you know, in regional parts of America, whereas cricket is still much, very much a sport of the elite. So you talk about it more. My guess is, and this is not a polo podcast, but my guess is polo would be another sport that would probably have too much reporting in America in that time compared to some of the American sports.
Yeah, all of those slave owners slash authors were definitely writing about it. Here's a fun story for you. I know I said no diversions, but I was working for Ontario Lottery and Gaming in Toronto back as a young professional. I was still in university. It was an internship. And I had Crickinfo open as a tab throughout the working day because I needed to check scores.
Obviously.
A month into the job, Crickinfo got blocked. And I was like, oh, I have upset a lot of South Asians over here. This was clearly me. They blocked it because of me. But anyway, coming back
was
to...
Just one added thing. I think it was cricket.com.au that had a page where you could get the cricket scores from. But when you looked at it, it looked like a spreadsheet. So it looked like you had a spreadsheet open if your boss walked past, but actually you had the cricket scores. I think it was cricket.com.au. It was the most genius thing they ever did. I mean, I was probably, I don't know if anyone ever used it. It was more of a gimmick, but I was just like that. I'm 100% down with that.
This was also before the age of mobile data. So I had to open it on the computer, right?
Yeah, anyway. You were stuffed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there were days where I actually was following more scores than doing work. So I'm sure a lot of South Asian
every
people.
Worker, how do you think I got this job? How did you get this job? It's the same thing.
Anyway, coming back to cricket in America, the first ever international match was played in Manhattan. If you haven't heard about it already from some commentator covering the T20 World Cup, which is ongoing, it was played between the USA and Canada in 1844, which Canada won, by the way, woohoo, by 23 runs. Both countries still play cricket matches against each other as part of the KAOT Cup, which is the longest running rivalry between any two countries in any sport. And that is amazing because cricket is not a main sport in either of those countries right now. And that game in 1844 was watched by around 5,000 spectators in the ground. And some claims say that they were close to 10,000 supporters. That just goes on to show us just how popular cricket was in that region back in the mid-19th century.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket 8 is your place for cricket intelligence. Yeah. And remember, at that stage, it was largely a betting sport. I mean, you could argue it still is, but more publicly a betting sport. You know, you have a major event like that. Cricket was still a big enough thing. You could see why you would have a draw. And I think there was a lot of money bet on that particular game, is my memory of that game. It's an interesting one. We call it an international one. So for years, I don't know if you know this, but for years, it was the America's Cup claimed to be the first ever international sporting event.
Oh.
And then people started going, well, wait a minute. There was a game billed as USA versus Canada. And then the yachting people got really, really upset and went, whoa, wait a minute. If you actually look at it, these were two teams who said they were playing as USA and Canada, but they weren't actually selected as teams. And it's like, yeah, what about the yachting stuff? And it gets a little bit, then you realize it wasn't like there were proper selection committees that went around to look for the best yachters in a country or anything like that, right? Like, it was all kind of private ownership or clubs or whatever and that sort of stuff. But it's a really interesting fact that, you know, I think now a lot of cricket fans knew, but I don't even think 10 years ago, most cricket fans knew that was the case. And again, it shows you in both of those countries that cricket was a fairly important thing. And we've just talked about how, you know, it was played by the elite. And so it was written about and everything. It wasn't 5,000 elite people that were there, right? It was a lot of people who were going who just wanted to see a sporting event. So you know that it certainly had some cut through at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I only found out about this when I was living in Canada, because I think at some point it just came up somewhere and I was a cricket guy. So I think some wise old Canadian was like, oh, do you know Bairam? And I was like, oh, I did not. But anyway, from 1859 to 1873, three English cricket squads toured North America. The 1859 one was actually the first English team to tour anywhere across the globe. And W.G. Grace was part of the 1868 team. Was that the peak of cricket's popularity in the continent?
Probably in the continent, I would have said. It's starting to... I've got a book on the history of baseball, but I can't remember it off the top of my head. But I think that's about the time baseball really takes over. And from that point forward, obviously, you know, there's only so much room in this town, you know, physically make ovals as much as anything else. But so, yeah, I think, and W.G. Grace going over there was a very big thing. Again, he was the most famous athlete in the world.
Yeah.
Right. Like he went to many, many different countries because of how famous he was, because there weren't a lot of people like that. So, yeah, I think that's probably it. It remained very popular in different parts of America, but overall, probably so.
Yeah. W.G. Grace, of course, was an amateur cricketer. For all of those who don't know, he wasn't a professional, and games in which he was playing were more expensive to watch. That's stuff that I've learned from Jared, of course. Anyway,
also, he got paid more than the professionals did, even though he's an amateur. Yeah.
Of course.
Funny that.
Anyway, the Civil War plays a huge role over here in the decreasing popularity of cricket in the USA. And that is around the same time as well. The 1860s, I believe, that's when the Civil War was happening. And basically, soldiers in camps realized that baseball took far less time and it could be played anywhere. And cricket needed a pitch which needed to be curated properly and looked after. And Harry Wright, who was a bowler and coach at the St. George's Cricket Club in New York, he also played baseball. And post-war, he was signed up by baseball team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings. And then, of course, his team went on to win 57 games without losing a single game in 1869. So clearly, he was a very talented coach. And that kind of tells you how far-reaching the impact of the American Civil War was with respect to cricket.
Yeah, and I think... again, it's one of those things of America was in obvious absolute turmoil and it wasn't particularly easy to get the conditions. And I don't think cricket quite, I think because of baseball and wicket, cricket developed in a different way than it did in the subcontinent would be a really good example where, you know, the Parsi start playing it and they play it amongst themselves and they become very big at cricket. Whereas there were little pockets that played cricket. There were little pockets who played wicket. There were little pockets who played baseball. Little pockets that played softball, probably. Do you know what I mean? All these different sports happening. And I think a lot of people knew about all those sports. And that's what I was saying before, this sort of hybrid element of a lot of those different things. When you and I know that if the Pakistan or the New Zealand soldiers were at war, they would find a way to play cricket now. But at that stage, it was very much you needed a rolled surface. You couldn't get plastic bats or any. Do you know all those sorts of little things? The balls, and everything else. It was probably just easier to play baseball, and most people would have been aware of both sports probably up until 1860. I think it'd be very rare to think that there wasn't people who didn't know about both the sports.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, clearly the evidence suggests that both of those sports were competing against each other for the longest time. But as a result of the Civil War and all of that stuff, cricket did become restricted to the elite even more so. It was an elite sport prior as well, but now it was strictly for the elite and popularity died down big time. Philadelphia, however, became a big cricket hotspot by the 1880s. And the Gentlemen of Philadelphia, which was their first-class team, played 74 first-class matches as well, winning 29. So it wasn't even a terrible team, right? Of course, they lost more than they won, but they won 29 games. That said, when the ICC was formed in 1909, with England, Australia, and South Africa being full members, you know, America did not opt to join them. And perhaps it's because the elites also found other sports like tennis and golf. It is a bit tragic, no?
So 1909, the ICC thing is quite interesting. I think if America wanted to join the ICC, I think it would have happened. But I also think that South Africa set it up in a way that you had to be a Commonwealth country. And that very much appealed to England, who then ratified that decision. And that made it very interesting for the USA. And I think Ireland with the two countries that maybe could have said, wait a minute, we play cricket, you know, we would like to be involved with this as well. But it wasn't, you don't remember, sport wasn't that organized. I don't know if you've ever studied the early history of the Olympics, but it's wild. You know, just people turning up to the Olympics going, I'm representing this country. I've never been to that country before, right? Like, and I don't mean it in a case of like today where you're just like, oh, I'm trying to qualify forever. They were just like, I'm from Botswana and I'm going to, you know, run in the 100 meters. Because there's already four Americans running in 100 meters or whatever it may be. There were all these different things happening across sport that was very rare. And people just turning up to the Olympics, competing when they clearly weren't Olympians and things like that. And that's that period, right? That's 1896, 1900, 1904, that sort of, you know, 1908 period where it's all a bit wild. Then World War One happens.
Yeah.
I think if World War One didn't happen, cricket was pretty big up until World War One in America. Like, it still had a foothold, more so in Philadelphia, as you just said, which is kind of an interesting story on its own. I think that could have happened. But South Africa, I think it was Abe Bailey was his name, who was really, really clear it had to be a Commonwealth sport. Fucked over
what
cricket.
What was the name? What was the name of the ICC back in the day? Imperial what?
Imperial Cricket Conference.
There you go.
Right? And it didn't have to be called that, of course. There's no reason for it to be called that. But yeah, Abe Bailey, I think it was Abe Bailey. I hope I haven't got his name wrong, but a man who made lots of money from gold mines in South Africa. It seems like he was the one pushing for that. And, you know, that, as I said, it made a lot of English people feel superior probably as well. So they went with it. Looking back, you know, that was the mistake of cricket and probably, you know, eventually allow for other sports to completely swamp it because other sports were open to whoever wanted to play them and cricket wasn't. Yeah. And we missed out on America.
Yeah.
If that happens, I'm not saying cricket becomes a major sport in America because I think a similar thing, I think Ireland and America were very, very anti-cricket because of England, right? But I also think that I know this for a fact, they both continued to play it. And if they were playing test matches, things would have developed and cricket probably would have ended up in the college system in America at the very least.
True.
And that would have changed things quite a bit. So it's just little things like that. But you're right. I don't think there was a huge movement in America to become a test nation. I've never looked into this. Me and Abhishek, it might be something worth looking into. I would wonder how many teams ever talked about test status. I know this for a fact that part of the reason that Pakistan got their test status was because there was talk of Canada getting test status as well. And the two of those went hand in hand because obviously the Western countries were not too happy that they'd already let India in and now they're going to be letting Pakistan in. And they were like, well, you know, who's to say Pakistan is better than Canada? Maybe we can let Canada in. And that was a legitimate conversation. If they had been that racist and anti-empire earlier, we could have, you know, West Indies probably should have been playing, you know, quite early on. And USA and Ireland are certainly two other teams that could have been probably India by that point as well. So we could have moved cricket on a little bit more. And, you know, New Zealand got, I think New Zealand partly got their test status so early because India and West Indies were the other two countries. And the racism of the people of that time wanted another, because New Zealand were nowhere near worthy of that. So it's a really messy thing. But you still have to understand that in America, they had another sport and they weren't particularly fond of the sport that was seen as English. And it's, I don't think it's a mistake either that football didn't grow as big in America. And maybe you could argue football didn't grow as big in Ireland as well. Like, those are the sports that England was pushing on the world. And those two countries kind of went, nah, we got our own sports.
Yeah, I mean, they call it soccer. That tells you a story on its own. But yeah, I'm going to blame Blood Diamond or whatever, Gold Mine Bailey.
Yeah, I think he was that's the guy. Gold, not diamonds. I think that was before they found all the diamonds. I could be wrong. Maybe he was involved with diamonds as well.
Blood Diamond Bailey just has a better ring to it than Gold Mine Bailey. Yeah. Anyway, let's come back to the golden age of cricket, which is this 1880s period to, you know, the start of the First World War. And you know, a cricketer emerged in America at this point who Don Bradman later described as America's greatest cricketing son. Philadelphian superstar called John Bartman King, or more commonly known as Bart King, he scored 16,000 runs at an average of 33 with 29 hundreds in matches which were recorded. If you go to the unarchived games as well, count them, then the hundreds go up to 39. And it also includes a game in which he hit 344 runs in 1902. And this was a guy who was primarily a fast bowler. So you're looking at the Aubrey Faulkner of America who bowls fast.
Yeah, he was incredible. We know that he was probably test quality. He dominated cricket in America as well. And, you know, we talked about before, that gentleman of Philadelphia, they had some good teams.
Yeah.
And he dominated their incredible backstory. Wasn't particularly one of the elites. A lot of the players who played for the gentlemen of Philadelphia were elite. He wasn't. Was a baseballer. There is talk of the fact that he might have, you know, used some of the baseball skills.
Yes.
And we know that Fred Spofforth studied baseball a little bit as well 20 years before Bart did. So we know that there's a link there well before we get to, you know, Adam Holyoake and the knuckleball and the split finger one with Adam, with Glenn McGrath and everything.
Yeah. Not so, Dilhara Fernando, Glenn McGrath. If you know, you know.
If you know, you know. So Barton King, we know he was incredible because the record that you just read out was from America. He comes and plays county cricket. I mean, he doesn't play county cricket, but he plays against counties and he plays first-class cricket in England and he fucking destroys.
Yeah.
We are talking about someone who bowled very fast with incredible control, the ability to move the ball both ways. You know, there were people in that time who thought he might have been the best fast bowler in the world in the early 1900s. Sid Barnes comes along not long after that and probably knocks him off. But, you know, he was absolutely devastating to anyone who tried to face him. My favorite story, which could be fake, but I'm going to say it till the end of time, which is that a county offered him the ability to marry a widow in that county because you had to be from the county to play for the county in those days. A bit like international cricket now. And they offered him a widow to marry to come over. And then obviously he'd make a fortune from playing county cricket. He thought that was a bit weird. But also I think he was quite a good baseballer as well. So I do think, obviously just a next level athlete. And, you know, you hear stories of those sorts of players in various countries. There's a great player from Mexico, for instance, you know, and a few other countries that have really, really good players. But this is, and you've got the Denmark, Danish players who played in county cricket. And they were good players. This is not a good player, right? This is a guy who dominated England when he came over to bowl. And we don't know how good he was because he never got to play international cricket. And clearly he was a test level bowler and probably as good as Fazal Mahmood, who was a brilliant bowler for Pakistan when they started test cricket. It's sort of what I'm trying to say is the sort of guy you could build a team around. So it's a real shame they weren't playing test cricket at that point. Remember that cricket is a funny game. 100 years before we protected our head, players looked after their groins. So don't be as stupid as old cricketers. Protect your computer now. NordVPN is the protection I use when facing cyber shortballs or when rights issues try to dismiss me. Geo-block so you can watch all the cricket you want. Grab your NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/Kimber.
I mean, 2,000 wickets in all of these unarchived games at 10.67 apiece. And if you look at his first class record, he's got 415 wickets at 15.65. So if you look at...
It's handy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That 415 wickets were basically 42% of his team's wickets. And this is a guy who's playing cricket when overarm bowling is just recently, you know, it's been made legal. It was made legal in 1864, which is also coincidentally the first year of the Wisden Cricket Almanac as well. But the craft was evolving in this period, right? Because overarm bowling was new. And Bart was one of the pioneers of swing bowling. Back in the day, it was called swerve, right? Not swing. And as you mentioned, his early days of playing some baseball helped him in developing that swerve. And he also used to hide his grip, which, I mean, Wasim was doing 100 years after, right?
It's incredible, isn't it? That no one did it between Barton King and Wasim Akram, right?
Like, yeah.
It's really, really interesting because I was watching my son the other day and he started doing it. And I said, where'd you learn that? He goes, I don't know. And I was like, I wonder if we just encourage bowlers not to do it and actually everyone should be doing it.
No. Freddie did it a lot as well after Wasim. Maybe he picked it up from his Lancashire days whilst playing.
Well, I mean, lots of bowlers did it after Wasim, but no one did it between Barton King and Wasim all that much from what we can tell.
Yeah, and he had this ball that nipped back into the right-hander, which he called the angler, which we now basically call an in-swinger, but I like the angler better. It's like you're catching a fish or something, right? He never got to play Test cricket. Sadly, we don't really get to hear of his name when we talk of cricketers from the golden age of cricket. It is quite tragic because he might just be the best ever player to never feature in a Test match.
He's certainly one of the best players ever from an associate nation. You know, there's some great early Indian players, of course, as well, some of which who did play Test cricket for other countries. And, you know, great early Sri Lankan players as well, you know, that have come through, and probably some great New Zealanders and everything else. But from a nation who are still not a Test nation and may never be a Test nation, Barton King, and we have a deeper understanding of how good he was because of what he did in county cricket. Whereas a lot of those great players like, you know, Ayal Bhula from Fiji, we know Ayal Bhula was really good because he smashed everyone every time he went over to New Zealand to play first class cricket, but he only played like 10 games or something. You know, we have a, you know, when you're talking about someone taking 400 first class wickets, you know, we know he was of a different level.
Yeah. Also, it's not just the 415 first-class wickets, but he actually played three first-class games versus the Australians. Back in 1893, Australia toured the USA on their way back from the Ashes, and they lost to the Gentlemen of Philadelphia by an innings, right?
Yeah.
Aussie skipper Jack Blackham back in the day, who you really like, his beard, right? He made it to your facial hair list.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said that the Americans were far better than what the Australians were led to believe and ranked with England's best. And on two subsequent Australian tours in 1896 and 1912, the Philadelphians won as well. Bart King took 24 wickets in these three games. So yeah, I mean, Philadelphia on its own could have been a test-playing nation back in the day because they were beating Australia.
I don't know how much worse they were than South Africa, honestly, around that late 1800s, early 1900s period. You know, we briefly touched on it before, but, you know, Argentina... USA and Ireland are three teams that by World War II should have all been test playing nations. And if we didn't have this stupid thing of having to be asked to be a test playing nation and whatever, they probably just would have become a proper cricket nation and cricket would have developed in a whole different way than it has now. But here we are.
Yeah. Some fun anecdotes from his playing time in England. Of course, he toured England for three seasons where he would play county teams in the county championship. In 1908, he had the best bowling average in the competition amongst all bowlers. And this is a guy who every time he toured took 70 plus wickets. So that on its own is an achievement. And in 1897 against Sussex, he scored 58 and took 13 wickets, 10 of which were clean bowled. He also cleaned up the great Ranji, first ball. And Ranji, as a result, gifted him a lighter with a ruby and his royal insignia, which is quite cool. Also,
I think that lighter is at the Connecticut Museum of Cricket.
Oh, that could be wrong. Definitely.
I think I'm right in saying that. There's a is it Hartford, Connecticut? I want to say has a cricket museum, and I think that lighter might be there, unless I'm getting it confused with something else. Well, but just point out what you said before. So in 1897, he tours England and he takes 72 wickets at 24.
Yeah.
11 years later, he goes back he takes 87 wickets at 11.
Yes.
Right? Like,
that's
we're
his
not
best
talking
season.
About, yeah, we're not talking about him just being a flash in the pan either. Like, he was good for a really long time.
I think in the season in between, maybe it was 1903, he took 76 wickets at maybe 16. So he kept getting better the more he was playing in England. And by the last season, which was what, 1908, he was the best bowler in the county circuit. In the 1903 season against Surrey, he took 6 wickets in a game, but also scored 98 and an unbeaten 113. His batting average in England was a decent 20, right, in county cricket. And based on all that info, you've got to say that he really missed out. Wrong place, wrong time, born in the wrong country, Bart King.
Definitely.
Yeah. One last thing on him before we move on is what you alluded to earlier, that he didn't come from an elite background. He was actually from a humble background, and that was not the way cricket was set up in the USA. It was a sport for the elite. And when he would tour England, people would call him Sir, and he would tell them that, no, call me Bart. And then, of course, there's the rich widow story. It's so crazy how he was an anomaly, even in his time, in every possible way. Not an elite cricketer, definitely the best American cricketer, and someone who, you know, if I was Bart King, I would have married that widow, you know? Maybe make a career out of cricket in England, because I'm guessing he probably didn't die a rich man.
No, I don't think so. I should remember that, but I know I've read on it before. But yeah, I don't think he did. So no, you're right. But in those days, it's not the same as now. And, you know, he would have had to leave the country he was in and all those sorts of things. He might've been in love with someone back home, all sorts of things. But yeah, it does seem weird he had that option, but it would have been nice if he didn't have to marry a widow to do it.
Yeah, I suppose so. Anyway, post-World War I, it's funny how all of the wars impact cricket in America. First the Civil War, now World War I. There is no first-class cricket played in Philadelphia after the First World War. And then, of course, Babe Ruth happened to America. So baseball overtook cricket completely. Weirdly enough, though, cricket did survive in some form on the West Coast, and that is thanks to Charles Aubrey Smith, who actually captained England versus South Africa in South Africa's first ever test. Also, this was the only test that Aubrey Smith ever played in his career. He took 5 for 19 and actually had 346 wickets in first-class cricket at 22 apiece. Then this man goes on to move to Hollywood and becomes an actor and becomes so big that he actually has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. What an arc! It's crazy.
It was a ridiculous career, because when he moved over, they were silent films. So he had a career as kind of a silent film actor, and then obviously he was still there when they were doing talkies. So he's in Tarzan. Which I think I've written about before. I called it the most athletic film ever, because Charles Aubrey Smith was in it, and also Johnny Weissmuller was Tarzan, who won all the gold medals in swimming for America. I think, was it America? I think it was America. So, you know, talk about, you know, Andrew Strauss and Michael Phelps starring in a film together. Like, it's such a bizarre thing to even think about now. But, I know Vinnie Jones and Jason Statham have been in some films. So we have had some athletes together before. But,
what was Jason Statham playing as a sport?
You don't know about Jason Statham was a diver.
I did not know that, no. I knew about Vinnie Jones, but not Jason Statham.
I'm not sure if Jason Statham made it to the Olympics, but I think he did World Championships and Commonwealth Games, I want to say.
I know Salil Ankola from India and Ajit Jadeja starred in Bollywood films. That was my only knowledge before Charles Aubrey Smith. But I Googled him and I saw his face and I recognized him. So you guys should go do that as well. He has a very unforgettable face. And if you've seen any old clips of American movies, this guy was popular. And the
he
story
was in
gets
so
better.
Many movies that quite often when you see a clip that's like copyright free, it's quite often his face. If you're looking at an old English gentleman. Do you know who Adam Dale is? Not Adam Dale. Alan Dale. I got the guy wrong. Alan Dale is, if you Google Alan Dale right now, there is no way you have not seen a TV show with him in it, right?
And how Alan many Dale, L's in Alan?
A-L-A-N-D-A-L-E. And so Alan Dale was another guy who moved to Hollywood really late. He was in Neighbours. I think he's from New Zealand originally, but he was in Neighbours and then moved to Hollywood. And he basically did like NCIS. I can't even remember. It's so many ridiculous shows that he did because he looks in it. He looks like an old distinguished kind of actor. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he just picked up role after role in these, you know, famous, you know, all these different things that are really, really famous. And he's been in, like, he was in Entourage, CSI, NCIS. Ugly Betty? Was that, yeah. I think that was one of the big ones he was in. You know, you just keep going through. And when you look at his career, well, he was in A Flight of the Conchords as well. And when you look at his career and you look at Charles Aubrey Smith's career, it's a similar kind of thing. They went over as a certain type of actor and just nailed those roles for like 20 or 30 years straight.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable. But yes, so he goes over and he's in Hollywood and there are many other English and Australian people in Hollywood. And, you know, in the case of someone like Errol Flynn, you've got someone who is English and Australian, right? Yeah. And so a lot of them are playing cricket, you know, and because of that, they then come up with their own cricket club, the Hollywood Cricket Club.
I'm just going to stop you there because there's another fun anecdote. There's another fun anecdote in this. So Charles Aubrey Smith, along with Boris Karloff, who, if no one recognizes the name, was Frankenstein's monster. And here's a fun fact for all of you. He was a wicketkeeper. So these guys founded the Hollywood Cricket Club in California. Yep. And this wasn't like test cricket level, but it kept the sport relevant in the United States, which is fantastic. It's amazing.
Well, teams would tour them and stuff and play against them, and it would make newspapers that they had them. And when they would play events, it would get reported on. You know, it was a big deal. And, you know, it was at a time when cricket was, there was a few games out there a bit like this. So, you know, you had the Authors 11, which has now been revived of modern times with slightly less famous people like me. you know, but you had the Actors 11, you had the Hollywood 11, you had all these different things. And, you know, there are a lot of famous people who played cricket, like, you know, Samuel Beckett and, you know, and Boris Karloff is another one of those. And there are photos of Boris Karloff, you know, standing on cricket grounds doing, you know, promotional photos, right?
Like it's amazing.
I think you can find one of him in his Hollywood Cricket Club blazer. I can't find it now.
I'm going to ask AI on WhatsApp to make a picture for me of Frankenstein's monster keeping wicket because we all need that.
I think there's also one of him. I'm trying to remember if he's like at a scorer's table or something. I'm trying to find it now. I can't find it. Oh, it's so annoying. I've seen it before. But he would pose for photos even at his home sometimes in his cricket kit.
Wow.
Like he was a proper cricket and there was heaps of them. Right. As I said, there were so many sort of English, Australian actors sort of around in that period. And, you know, that has kind of stuck around, like, you know, Hugh Jackman and Harry Potter and Russell Crowe, obviously. You know, Russell Crowe is the best example of this, of course, because he was related to two New Zealand cricketers. And, you know, but those stories, you go through and you find, you know, there's lots of archival stories about, so I read a lot about Hollywood. There's lots of archival stories about people playing cricket on sets of famous movies, right?
Oh,
and not just
fun.
In England, but in America. And like, you know, in the background playing cricket and all those sorts of things. So it's that kept it a little bit in the conversation at times, even if by that stage, cricket was largely a novelty and kind of a punchline really in America at that point.
Yeah, basically, it was more or less dead. I mean, the Don did visit America, of course, in between. That was still, of course, post-World War I, pre-World War II, if I'm not wrong. I can't quite remember the year. He scored tons of runs, met Babe Ruth.
Yeah,
everyone knew who he was. Yeah, and I mean, it was a big thing that Don Bradman was in America. But that is an isolated incident. And the cricket, you know, cricket as a sport was more or less dead. And we come to post-World War II now, right? America has had a fair few brushes with cricket. You mentioned Dwight Eisenhower in that test match in Karachi in 1959 and 60 and how matted surfaces were then rendered obsolete in Pakistan. A year after that, the USA Cricket Association was formed. And a year after that, the KA Auti Cup with Canada was resumed after more than 50 years. 3 years later, USA becomes an ICC associate member. But it wasn't until very recently, until those diaspora kids in the USA grew up, when the sport started to regain its popularity in that continent, because all of these Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Sri Lankan kids had grown up watching that sport with their parents, and now they wanted to play it.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8, cricket intelligence for you every day.
Yeah, there's, you know, you've got Peter Della Penna and John Boy as two American, you know, white Christian dudes, I'm just assuming. you know, like, norm, what you associate with normal American culture, both of them get into cricket while they're in Australia, right? And and so in America, the majority of the people who are involved in cricket have it brought over either by an Australian or a New Zealand parent, which sometimes happen, but more often it is by New Zealand, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lankan, because of the way the immigration works.
And the Caribbean.
Caribbean's massive, especially in certain parts. And, you know, so you get these sorts of things happen. And so it exists, but it is, you know, a very much a minority sport in many ways. Completely. And it's a minority and minority play, if that makes sense. It's like a double minority. but you do get little things like Crick Info was born in America. Now, partly that is because the USA had the internet and no one else did, but also because it makes sense to invent Crick Info in America, whereas it didn't make sense to invent Crick Info anywhere else, because everywhere else you had access to cricket, to newspapers that would have even foreign scores in it, right?
True.
America had no newspapers with any cricket scores in them anymore. So you either had to go and get the airmailed newspaper from your local country and read it in the library, which I know some cricket nerds did, or you use the internet and you create the world's biggest fan website for any single sport ever, right? Like, I don't think we've ever had anything like Crick Info before come out completely independently of fans and grow to what it is. And, you know, so there were things in America, there were people in America that still cared about the sport, but the playing level really dropped off. As I said before, it wasn't in the schools, which is the key issue that cricket really has. And it just isn't a major part of society at all, even though they still have, you know, a cricket team and, you know, they're still playing occasionally. They're not really relevant at all at a stage where, you know, Denmark is relevant, right? You know, where, you know, the Kenya becomes relevant. Like, there are lots of places without really a cricket background who are relevant at different times to cricket, and USA just isn't.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back in the day and somehow establish college cricket, right, when they had that opportunity and cricket was popular, that was probably the thing that could have propelled the sport in the States. But anyway, fast forward to 2015, a year which saw a significant boost for cricket in the USA. That is when Sachin's Blasters played Warne's Warriors in that Cricket All-Stars T20 series, right? Those games were held in baseball grounds, and those grounds were in New York, Houston, and LA. We saw massive crowds, crowds packed to the rafters. I was tuning in for those games, knowing very well that these guys are washed up cricketers who, you know, are far beyond their prime. Yeah. These guys were retired for years. But, you know, this was the most A-list of, you know, cricket stars that had ever featured in America, maybe in over a century, right? And everyone was super excited. Those games were extremely, like, closely followed. And in terms of being a potential commercial cash cow, that was probably the first instance where you were like, hey, wait a second, the US could invest in this.
Yeah. I mean, it only happened once, which tells you that maybe it didn't work perfectly. Whether it would have been, you would end up able to do it consistently. I think Crick Info is the first sign that you can make money off cricket. And the second sign is probably Willow TV, if we're being honest.
True. Willow's
they
huge.
Already existed and were really successful. So it already told you that there was a chance to make money in it. But you're right. I think having crowds turn up to games in America was quite big. You know, American cricket was such a shit show at that stage from the administration point of view, which sadly it still is. That, you know, there were so many issues going on with the way that cricket was run there. There was people who tried to get it off the ground and tried to do things. At least people turned up to that. But that is more, that was a lot of older people turning up to see their heroes from when they were kids. It is a little bit different than what Major League Cricket has become, right? And that next big boom. But
yeah,
it it again was a moment that showed you that cricket could still exist in America. And, you know, I've never talked to the Major League Cricket people about this, but my guess is that that probably played a part in some of their pitches to people. Mm. It's like, well, wait a minute, look what happened when this happened. You know, what if we do get Joss Butler and, you know, Shaheen Afridi and these guys out playing? Maybe people will come, right? Yeah. So, all these things play a part. But yeah, I do think that there were plenty of signs that cricket could have worked there, even if it didn't always work.
We already had some international cricket played actually prior to the 2015 Cricket All-Stars Series. New Zealand and Sri Lanka played three T20Is in Lauderhill in Florida. And we've seen on several occasions when a team is touring the West Indies, you'll have the odd T20 or two at Lauderhill.
CPL was
a huge avenue as well for American cricketers, right? Like you look at Ali Khan, Stephen Taylor, and Hayden Walsh Jr., who actually made the switch to the West Indies. It was sort of like the ecosystem was building.
Well, they were going to have a team in Florida. Hmm. And so I think it was Jamaica Telawalas played half their games in Florida one year. And it might have been another team played half their games another year. So it was on the cards that the CPL would go there as well. And there were two other leagues that I know of off the top of my head that were planning to start well before Major League Cricket as well. And when they started the Canadian League, the GT20 or whatever it was called, there was also going to be another one that they were hoping would go to America. So everyone was sniffing around for a while and had their same idea. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a major person in American sports media recently, and he was asking me about it. I said, America has long been the third rail. Everyone wants to get involved with it, but the minute you touch it, it usually crumbles in front of you. And look how close it was to Major League Cricket not going ahead. It was about three weeks before the tournament, it almost all fell apart. And that had incredible investors and a shit ton of money, and it still didn't work, right? Everyone's always dreamed of USA cricket, and it just has never quite worked the way that everyone would want.
Yeah, just in terms of, I know we're going to get to Major League Cricket, but in terms of international cricket, right? The USA have been around. We saw them in the 2004 Champions Trophy. I remember Clayton Lambert playing for them. And we've seen a fair few West Indian stars turn up for the USA. Clayton was one more recently. We've seen Xavier Marshall. We've seen Hayden Walsh Jr. go from the USA to the West Indies, which makes me wonder if the USA could be, you know, to the West Indies what Ireland is to England. You never know.
Well, the thing is that if it's run correctly, there could be more money in Major League Cricket than there is in the CPL.
Yeah.
So it should never be a feeder system in that direction, right? And if Major League Cricket works, then you would just go from Major League Cricket to franchise cricket around the world, right? You don't need the CPL anymore. So I think it could skip all those things. But yeah, it could be in the short term. What we've seen over the last couple of years is players basically retiring to the USA to become coaches/players. You know, Dane Peat and Corey Anderson, Liam Plunkett, and these sorts of players.
Rusty Theron has played for the USA.
Well, he was different. I don't know if you know this. Rusty Theron's got a great story. I should get him on the podcast. He's a lovely guy. He retired from cricket after playing in, I think he played in the IPL, didn't he? I think he played for Kings 11.
Yeah. He did.
Retired from cricket to study black literature in America.
Wow.
And was over in America. And then, I think, played a little bit of lower-level cricket. And that's when the Major League Cricket people, or Willow Cricket, or whoever it was at the time, found out about him. And that's how he ended up back in it. So he was even more random, right? Like, he'd moved to America separately. So, you know, and the same with Liam Plunkett and Corey Anderson. Neither of them really moved to America to coach cricket in America. I've done a podcast with Pudsey about it before. He was married an American woman, so he moved to America. And I think Corey Anderson was very similar. So, yeah. But that had happened before. Like, oh my God, I've forgotten the guy's name, which is going to annoy me, but it's Malcolm something. But the guy who Garfield Sobers hit for six sixes, he moved to America. He was a first-class cricketer from, Wales. And he moved to America and lived. And so there actually had been, and he's not the only one, other cricketers have lived in LA and in other cities in America from all around the world, right? First-class cricketers, test cricketers, international cricketers, all these different players.
Commentators, I believe Mike Haseman lives in America.
Yeah, and a lot of people in the West Indies as well. A lot of the West Indian players are there. But there was no structure, right? And so you get these weird things like Nicolas Pouren playing in the Houston Invitational Tournament, or, you know, and you see Rakim Cornwell playing in these random tournaments. That's been going on with especially with the West Indian cricketers for a long time.
Even but, in Toronto, there was a lot of West Indian influence.
Yeah, exactly. Right across North America. Yeah, yeah, you're right. And you know, you get expat people who bring these tournaments together and they get local sponsors and it's like a carnival and everything. But there's no actual cricket structure. And it's what we've had in the last 4 years, thanks to Major League Cricket, really, and Minor League Cricket, which is even more important in my eyes, is just that getting that structure to that next level. And, you know, realistically, as we've seen in New York, it's too early to have a World Cup. In the USA, they don't have many good pitches. They don't have many good grounds at the moment, right?
They need a quality lawnmower as well. That's what they need.
So they're a step away, but there is a lot of young, good talent that comes up in American cricket, and everyone is aware of that. It's can you maintain that and make sure that they don't leave and go and play other sports and everything else, which is hard because of the college system, because you play sport in America at college.
No, that's very true. But we've taken a lot of names over here, right? Expats who actually featured for the USA, like Leighton Lambert, Xavier Marshall, Rusty, who has an interesting story, and you should get on the Red Inca at some point. Corey Anderson is currently playing this T20 World Cup that is ongoing. And then Liam Plunkett moved there, Dane Peat, Unmukt Chand from India, Sami Aslam from Pakistan, along with a bunch of some other Pakistanis.
Some Sri Lankans, I think, as well. Some Sri Lankan first-class cricketers, yeah.
A lot of these guys have moved there and are playing some format of cricket. Mohammad Asif lives in the USA as well.
Does.
Would you say the future of American cricket is expat and that is the way to go?
No, but, you know, this is what I hate more than anything is, like, people will see the American team now and they go, oh, it's just a bunch of Indians and Pakistanis and Kiwis and South Africans, right? And it's like, yeah, let's go back to the first South African team.
Yeah.
How many South Africans were playing and how many people were, at the very least, South African English? Have a look at the first Australian teams. And there were players who qualified for both teams and quite often played for both teams. This has been, it's how cricket has evolved, and it's a weird sport in that kind of way. You're not going to, no one in America thinks that the future is recruiting Corey Andersons, right? Hmm. And Corey Anderson's like a top level recruit for them. But no one in American cricket thinks that's the future, right? But it is the present. And also, if you want young people to watch this sport, and they see, if there was casual American kids watching the other night, watching that USA team, knowing very little about cricket, and they see the USA smashing Canada everywhere and sixes going out the park, do they care that Aaron Jones is American but also is Bayesian and grew up with Jofra Archer? Because he's both. He has more mixed heritage than some of the other players when it comes to his background. But do they care? Probably not. They'd probably rather that than some, you know, accountant who's 26 who stayed in cricket all of his life rather than going to other sports because he wasn't particularly athletic, who manages to get into the team and can't hit the ball off the square, right? Like, at a certain point, That has to matter. But we have seen many great cricket cultures come out of expats, right?
Yeah.
Ireland is the most obvious recent one. You can throw the Netherlands, right? You know, the Netherlands now had a Dutch-born captain who definitely deserved to be their captain in Peter Saylor, right? And then you have their new all-rounder coming through. And then you have some of the kids coming through in their team. And you're like, okay. So all those jokes about them being, you know, South Africa B, probably won't mean as much in 15 or 20 years' time. And no one makes jokes about that when it comes to South Africa or Australia or New Zealand anymore, right? And
that's very true.
You know, even Pakistan had a guy called, you might know this, is it Duncan Sharp?
Oh, is it? I do not know this. I need to know this.
Pakistan had a player called Duncan Sharp, who I think was born in, he's born in India, but, you know, it would have been Pakistan eventually. Who was a white guy who played cricket for Pakistan. Played a test match or two test matches, I think, for Pakistan.
Wow.
Clearly his family was probably, would come, well, I'm assuming that his family was English or Australian. I know he retired to Australia. I think he might have been played for South Australia. But you know what I mean? Like, and we've talked about this before. Douglas Jardine was supposed to captain India, right? We've... This is how this if you have a problem with America picking Corey Anderson, you have a problem with the way that cricket has almost always been everywhere. And that is just how it is, right? And it grows in a way that is very different. And it goes back to the start of this episode of we didn't develop this sport correctly from the beginning. Mm. And because of that, we got a bit stuck. And sometimes you need a Trent Johnston so that you can get to a Josh Little.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8, the new home of cricket intelligence.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Plus, I'm all for diaspora teams. I'm a naturalized Canadian citizen, right? It makes me happy that at least Canada is playing this T20 World Cup.
You would play for Canada?
I could qualify for Canada, but I probably wouldn't be good enough.
No, obviously you wouldn't be good enough. Yeah. We're all aware of that. But I'm saying, you feel Canadian. You feel like you could play for Canada. But then if you play for Canada, people will be like, wow, you're Pakistani. And you're like, well, I've spent a lot of my life in Canada. Where am I? And that's also the modern world, right?
Formative years in Canada. Most of my values are Canadian. I don't know, like that's kind of the country that shaped me, even if my roots are Pakistani, which also I'm very proud of. So I feel like it's a very normal thing to feel closely associated to two different countries. And that is why I support the diaspora teams. Plus, to your point, it's a cyclical process. Ultimately, one day we'll get teams where cricketers who are born in that particular country will you know, rise to the occasion.
This is such a tangent, but who's the manager of the English football team?
Gareth Southgate.
So Gareth Southgate was interviewed about something, and it really, I don't know anything about any of this sort of shit, but something he said really stuck to me. He said, when you look at the under 21 hopefuls for England, so many of them qualify for two and three teams. And he said, that is just the world that we are getting into.
Yeah.
That is never going to go away. You know, Jofra Archer qualifies for two teams, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have guys playing county cricket who have Australian accents. There are so many different players from around the world in different backgrounds and everything else. That's only going to happen more. But for cricket to be successful in America, a kid who grows up in bumfuck Idaho, right, has to know that the sport exists.
Yes.
And he has to have some kind of access to it as a fan, as someone who can go down to his local game, as someone who can play in it. You know, maybe it's at a college that he goes to or whatever that may be, right? If you don't have that, then it's probably never going to be an actual success in America. And if you do have that, it can become, you know, something like football or even rugby, which is getting quite big. You know,
even from a fan perspective, Jared, you need to have that one brown friend who you visit and they're watching cricket, right?
Yeah, the father is on the thing yelling at the TV and you're like, what is this happening? It's that sort of stuff. And, you know, the world is changing. And I know there's a lot of people, I've got so much feedback on email over the last couple of days of people who found my channel in the last week, right?
Okay.
And are emailing me going, where can I learn more? And over the last two or three years, I had so many Americans who have found cricket of recent times. And occasionally I'll be on a baseball or a basketball podcast. And, you know, suddenly I get a bunch of people going, I'm really fascinated in this game. I really like listening to you. Who do I read next? Who do I listen to? What do I watch? What do I need to do? Mm. Right? Americans get obsessed with sport. Cricket is a sport that is built for obsession more than most sports, right? It has so much minutiae. And I remember watching all those American soccer fans get obsessed with football, right? And like they would nerd out over these little things. I was like, wait until they get into cricket. It's going to blow their balls off.
Absolutely. Anyway, to cap this podcast off, of course, we've spoken about the Major League Cricket and how it has had its inaugural season last year, and it is bound to propel cricket in America and make it more popular. That is almost a sure shot thing with the amount of investment that's coming in as well. And currently, the USA is also hosting the T20 World Cup alongside the West Indies. Do you think that this particular World Cup can do for cricket in America what perhaps the 1994 FIFA World Cup did for football/soccer in America?
No.
Hmm.
Because of
the New York surface?
Partly.
Or playing conditions?
I think because at that time, football, there was already the Volvo driving soccer mums cliche and all that sort of stuff. And I think there was already Pelé had played over there, right?
Yes.
I think football was bigger. And then you had, of course, the, you know, Mexican influence of so many, you know, Mexicans living in America and being... and that having an impact on culture and everything else. So I think football was bigger over there, and then you don't have things like the pitch problems, I think, is a small part of it. Having said that, it doesn't mean that it can't be the first big domino, right? You know, Los Angeles Olympics is obviously going to be something else that we will be looking at. There will be there will be more and more things going ahead when it comes to cricket. So it may not be 94 football, but I think Americans, my memory of America, you know, of knowing Americans, of being in America, and you know, what did Lars von Trier say? I've never been to America, but I've imbibed every bit of their culture, so I don't need to go there. A lot of us have felt that way. They like a lot of niche things, right? Mm. It's a country of really broad tastes and really niche tastes all together. There's plenty of room for cricket to become quite big over there. How it develops, I don't know. Does it become another sport separate to baseball that works really well? Does it become a sport that works really well in cities because there is diaspora to prop it up, right? And, you know, does it become the sport of you know, a couple of major cities? Like, we already know Houston is one that has taken off in. Something like that?
Texan cricket scene is quite vast. My cousin went to UT Austin.
Oh, it's huge, yeah.
For university. He used to play cricket all the time.
So, you know, and there's heaps of little bubbles like that in different parts. Mm. Is women's cricket a thing, right? Look at women's football in America, right? All their major football stars are basically women, right?
Yep.
If they brought college cricket in now and played it properly and made men and women get scholarships for it, I can promise you their women's team is going to get a lot better than their men's team in the short term. There's many different options for how it becomes a sport. And, you know, we're seeing that with rugby. We're seeing that with soccer. You know, we're seeing that with other sports that are crossing over to America as well. So, yes, all those things, I think, are a potential pathway. But I don't think this particular World Cup is going to be the thing that starts the momentum. However, it's probably another, you know, small domino in the row.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to give them some infrastructure. Obviously, the renovations and the new stadium, but they need structure. And maybe somewhere down the line, if they get foreign investment from India or Saudi for the Major League Cricket, you know, teams, maybe that's something that propels it further. But I feel like this is an untapped market. And at one point, it's just going to rise exponentially, rather than gradually. That's my feeling with cricket in America.
This is what I think will happen. Hmm. However it rises, it won't be because of what someone has done in cricket administration. Hmm. I think if you look at rugby and football, and you could probably name some other smaller sports as well, something usually happens in that it gets a foothold in a couple of schools or a couple of colleges, and then it becomes a thing that a certain class or a certain section of the society get involved in, and then it moves forward, right? And I think football had a couple of different ways that it did that. Rugby, obviously, a lot less, but is still, you know, probably, I don't know if rugby's bigger than cricket in America, but it's comparatively to how big rugby is as a sport, it's doing better in America than that. Mm-hmm. So I think that cricket will find a way, and the biggest hassles that cricket has is the way that the global game is run and the way that the game is run in America. Mm-hmm. That is the issue that the sport has, right? And that isn't going to go away. But once America, enough people in America decide that something is worthy, they can make anything work, right? And we need no more proof of that than the fact that they voted Donald Trump in.
Yeah.
Right? Like, at a certain point, if they just believe in something enough, they just convince themselves it's a thing. And I remember watching, you know, football was a laughing stock in America for years. And then step by step, you just kept going, oh, the mums are into it. And the mums think it's not as violent as American football. And then you're like, I'd never even thought of that. Of course it isn't. Right. And, you know, little things like that. You have no idea how it's going to start, is the point. And I think that's the fascinating thing about America, is how that goes. And you said before, it's the untapped market. Look, everyone in the last 25 years in cricket knows this, right? Mm-hmm. With
anyone in cricket can do anything to help it is the interesting part of it. A lot of smart people have worked at American cricket organizations and they get absolutely screwed over by the politics over there. A lot of smart people have tried to start leagues up over there and the leagues have never even existed. Major League Cricket, hanging on by a thread, right? All these different things, we know that it could work, but it is cricket's third rail. Maybe this World Cup, followed by the Olympics after, you know, if Major League Cricket can keep going, it just gets the momentum going in the right direction. And I can't see how Americans can't be obsessed with cricket because it's such a sport that once you get into the weeds on, you're not coming out. I'm not saying the whole country will get into it. I'm not saying it's going to be bigger than baseball or ice hockey or anything like that. But if it was the 15th biggest sport in America, that would still be a huge thing for our sport overall. And absolutely, we don't just want America. We want all countries, really. Absolutely. But America brings with it the ability to spread cricket to other countries on its own.
And shout out to John Boy and Peter Delapena for doing lots of good work of promoting the sport in the USA. Let's see, Jared, in 5 years' time, what we're talking about with respect to cricket in America. But that's it for this podcast. And thank you to everybody who stuck around till minute 69. Hey. And if you enjoyed this podcast, give us a like and subscribe to both this channel and Jared's other channel on YouTube. And a quick reminder that you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage because that can serve as your one-stop shop for all of the work that we do as part of the Good Areas team, whether it be written content, podcasts, or videos. We'll see you next week for another episode of Footmarks. That is all for now. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recording. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.